Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings to all of you. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Glad to be back with you once again. Two news events on opposite sides of the world are stage setters for the program we have for you this evening. One occurred off the coast of Japan 2 days ago. A massive earthquake, 7.6 on the Richter scale, had that part of the world on the lookout for another killer tsunami, the kind that killed thousands of people in Japan not too long ago, and which, more tellingly, took out a nuclear power plant at Fukushima. Judging by the amount of coverage that nuclear disaster gets in this country's mainstream media, you might think the mess had all been cleaned up, put away. Everything's back to normal, peachy keen. It isn't. Far from it. Every single day, the nuke plant at Fukushima pumps thousands of gallons of radioactive gunk into the ocean. And scientists are seeing evidence that the contamination has already spread to the western coast of the U.S. Could take years to get the situation under control, if ever, but we hear very little about it. Tonight, we'll do what we can to refocus public attention on what is shaping up as one of the great ecological catastrophes of all time. In the second half of the program, we'll be joined by Dr. Helen Caldicott to hear about the true costs and dangers of this disaster and why it has seemingly dropped off the public's radar screen. The other news event of note happened in Washington, D.C. this weekend, where thousands of people, I think from more than 100 different organizations, gathered to raise hell about the NSA's massive and sweeping surveillance program, an ongoing program, by the way, which amounts to an all-encompassing total surveillance in which the NSA has the ability to save, download, and snoop through every email, every tweet, every Facebook posting, every cell phone call, every communication in the world, basically, supposedly, so our government can monitor a couple thousand terrorists around the planet, see what they're up to. As we've learned through the leaked documents from Edward Snowden, the spying by our intelligence agencies goes far beyond a search for terrorists. Our allies are outraged that their leaders' cell phones were tapped, along with everyone else's. The damage to America's international reputation, our standing as the supposed good guys in the world, has been incalculable. I think the protests in Washington this weekend are an appropriate backdrop for our first guest tonight. Filmmaker Oliver Stone and historian Peter Kuznick joined me last December, you might recall, to talk about their massive project. It was a book, The Untold History of the United States. That book was also the basis for a just concluded documentary series on Showtime by the same title, narrated by Oliver Stone. That series is now being made available on DVD and Blu-ray if you missed it on Showtime, and a paperback version of their book is also now out. It's probably impossible to calculate how many arguments this history of our country has generated around dinner tables or water coolers or in coffee shops or in classrooms since it came out last year, but the whole idea of how we see ourselves, how the rest of the world sees us, the idea of American exceptionalism and the questions of whether we aspire to be an American empire are fraught with emotion. They generate heated opinions on all sides, but they're too important to ignore. Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick have returned to the program and are prepared to defend their take on the last 75 years of American history, a history that is far different from what some of us learned in school and may be hard for some of us to accept, but which need to be considered by Americans of all political stripes and persuasions. We have a lot of ground to cover, so let's get to it. Put on a pot of Joe, turn up the audio, settle down into that Barca lounger, and strap yourselves in, because here we go. Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick with The Untold History of the United States, right after our first break on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Knapp. If you're like me, you grew up believing that America is a force for good. You learned in school that we're the good guys, that we enter wars reluctantly and always for altruistic reasons, that we Americans are special, a force for good in the world, a beacon of freedom. That view of our country is not new. I mean, not at all, but it's assumed a new and special place in the national discourse and is a subject that will immediately raise hackles, start arguments. It's almost become a litmus test of whether you love your country or not. It's also a central theme in this massive multimedia project, The Untold History of the United States. That's the title of a hardcover book. It's now out in paperback, and a documentary series on Showtime, written and produced by my guest tonight, acclaimed and controversial filmmaker Oliver Stone, who I think I read he has more than 30 Academy Award nominations to his credit, including a couple of wins, and historian Peter Kuznick, who both of whom joined me last December when they kicked off the project. We are thrilled to have them back tonight and for the next 2 hours. Oliver and Peter, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Nice to be here,
George. It's nice to be back.
Yeah, I'd like to start with a sort of a question about context. You two know better than anyone how quickly a discussion of American exceptionalism and our country's true legacy can degenerate into name-calling and nastiness. And a reaction to your project, I think, is probably dependent on the ideology of the reader or the viewer. Oliver, do you worry that you're preaching to the choir, that the battle lines are so rigidly drawn that people who might benefit the most from learning more about American history simply aren't going to listen, the reaction being visceral and immediate, and nothing that you have to say will get through?
Well, you said a lot there, George. I think you're certainly right about certain people. I really hope you're wrong about others, because a fresh mind, not getting locked in, trapped. For example, I grew up, I was raised and educated conservatively. My father was Republican. I went to schools in New York City and Pennsylvania, and I went on to Ivy League college. I believed what my father told me and what I was educated to believe. The books said so, and we seemed to have done the right thing in World War II and Korea and so forth, and Vietnam even. But when Vietnam came along, and I was a young man, I went over there, and of course, it didn't change me radically like right away. It took years after the war of talking to people, of reading, having insights. The Church Committee happened, Watergate happened. We began to really realize as young people that the government lies. Governments all over the world lie, not just the United States government. And in the 1960s and 70s, that was more and more apparent. What's shocking now to me is that a generation later, a lot of the young people still don't realize it. And they're buying the lies. They bought them in Iraq. They bought in Kuwait and Afghanistan. But I don't believe people have to be locked into a rigid point of view. I've learned. I've changed. It took me 30 years, 35 years to start to change. And I'm still learning. And frankly, until I started the series in 2008 with Peter, who was a professor at American University, I learned so much more in the last 5 years. I'm still learning from people who are arguing with us and bringing up fine points. I'm deepening my love of history equals really my love of country. It's not a critique of America. It's a loss of, for me, a loss of what the idealism and the possibilities of America, the dream of America. I believed it. I've fought for it, and I've seen it just kind of vanish into something I don't recognize anymore. So that's what motivated me to make the history with Peter.
Oliver, you and then Peter can tackle this one. I just wanted you to speak for a moment about the range of reactions you've had to the book and then the TV series. I can imagine I know a lot of it's positive because I've read the reviews, but yeah. I know a lot of it has had to be negative too. We had people who, even before you came on the show last time, didn't want to hear it. They don't want to hear it.
They don't want to hear it. That's the important thing. They don't want to. Let's open. That's what we have to get past. People, for example, the Kennedy murder. They were all over the newspapers, the establishment, the news shows, the documentaries. And they just go on and they say, history seems to have decided that Lee Oswald was the assassin. It's sort of been accepted, and the facts show that. But they never quote any facts. And at the same time, they never quote a book like that has contradicted the Warren Commission, whether it be Robert Groden or Cyril Wecht or Gary Aguilar, or they just don't even, or Douglas, James Douglas with JFK and the Unspeakable. They don't go there. They don't even read the stuff. So that's what I fear in this world, is that people are locking off their views without trying to learn something more about it.
Well, I definitely want to talk about JFK a little bit later. Peter, what's it been like for you? Roller coaster?
It's not really a roller coaster. I mean, I'm in the world of academia. And in the world of academia, these ideas are much more widely accepted than they probably are in mainstream America. The discourse that goes on at the high school level and the public school level and the way they approach history is more along the conventional lines, the lines that we're challenging. But the universities, the good universities, there's a much more radical critique going on, and we fit right into that because we're not coming out from some crazy position. What we're arguing is basically the position that's been argued by progressive scholars for decades, certainly since the 1950s. And we're in that tradition. We've added a lot to that. I think our analysis provides the best ammunition for this point of view and the best defense, the best evidence, the best examples for this point of view. But it's within academia, it's been pretty well received. The way you started the discussion raised an interesting point to me about the people we were having trouble reaching. I would bet that what we're saying will resonate better now with your listeners than it did last December with some of your conservative listeners. Some of the things that have come out this past year effectively reinforce exactly what we were saying. We warned about the surveillance state long before Edward Snowden blew the whistle on the specifics about what was going on in terms of surveillance. We had that. We have a lot of that in our Chapter 10 of our documentary. We have that in our book. We saw that coming. And this is the patterns that have been developing. What we're looking for in this untold history are patterns, and patterns that go back to the 19th century, patterns that recur over and over again in our history, our recourse to military solutions, our bombing of other countries, our interventions, our overthrowing governments, our acting in ways that might be in the interest of corporate America, but they're not in the interest of most Americans. And I think that people are getting that increasingly, which makes them more responsive to our message.
Oliver, why is it important to take on the idea of American exceptionalism other than just to, you know, take us down a couple of pegs?
I don't look at it as coming down a couple of pegs. I look at it as trying to say, are we going to join history? Are we going to join the international community and try to see other countries and their issues through their eyes as opposed to always our own eyes? There's a tremendous arrogance in our ethnocentricity. The fact that we're even talking like this, that you're asking me that question, the way you ask it is like we have the right to do as we wish. So we are outside history. We're exceptional. We're blessed by God. If you're religious or if you're atheist, I think you feel as if we're blessed by some divine force that has operated in this country, be it capital, money, luck. You know, the great break that we showed in the book and the film series was World War II, was put us in an extraordinary position where we were by default the number one power in the world, richest one, and we had, because the British Empire was so broke and we took over from it in the Turkish-Greek conflict of 1947, we started to really run the show with the atomic bomb, with the money, with the control of the international currency system. We really stepped up, and with Truman declaring this a national security state in 1947, what happened between 1947 and 1960 alone, between Truman and Eisenhower, two presidents, is astounding. The growth of that state and security. I mean, it was like the George Bush thing after 2001. This acceleration happened. Massive amount of atomic bombs were built, weapons, missiles. And it began. We began a ride, so to speak, through history where we just assumed we had the right to the nuclear threat, which we had dropped successfully on Japan in 1945. And Peter, maybe you should just go on a little bit about the nuclear threat, because I think it needs to be outlined up to today.
Oliver is talking about how it develops under Truman and Eisenhower. Well, the United States, of course, had a monopoly on atomic bombs, but even while we had the monopoly, even before we tested our first bomb, the scientists warned Truman and the other leaders that there's no secret to the bomb, that what we're flaunting now and holding over people's heads, other countries are soon going to develop, which is what happens with every weapon system. Why the example that Obama set with drones was so dangerous, because once, maybe at one point, we're the only ones who can use drones to kill other people, but China's developing a whole range of drones. Iran is developing drones. About 50 countries have access to drones now that they're developing or that they've bought. The same thing happened with nuclear weapons. And so we built up our monopoly. Then the Soviets test theirs in August of 1949. Then we moved to the hydrogen bomb. And when Eisenhower took office, we had a little more than 1,000 atomic bombs. When Eisenhower left office, we had 23,000 atomic bombs. When his budgeting cycle was finished during the Kennedy years, we had 30,000 atomic bombs. So, but from the very beginning, before Truman even dropped the bomb, he was warned on several occasions that he was building a weapon, not just a more destructive weapon, but a weapon that could end all life on the planet. And he says this on these three occasions. And he still proceeds to use the atomic bomb in Japan in the way that he was warned was the most dangerous in terms of provoking an arms race with the Soviet Union, which is what happened. But we've managed, fortunately. Gorbachev plays an important role in this, and he and Reagan came very close at Reykjavik to actually reaching an agreement that was going to abolish all nuclear weapons. Reagan, however, clung so doggedly and so stubbornly to Star Wars, which the concept has been totally repudiated now. It's not what we're working on now. And had Reagan been willing to give that up, or not to just give it up, but to restrict it to the laboratory for 10 years, Gorbachev was willing to give up all nuclear weapons. But Reagan refused to do that. So we still have a situation where we've got 17,000 or so nuclear weapons left in the world. Thousands of them are on hair trigger alert that are pointed at Russia. Is Russia our enemy now? We've got thousands pointed at them. They've got thousands pointed back at us. And we still have this Cold War mindset in so many ways that we've not escaped from yet. And the nuclear threat is one of the big ones. I heard that you're going to be talking to Helen Caldicott later. Helen's a friend, and we work along similar lines on this, and you're going to talk about Fukushima. But the danger of this kind of approach to nuclear energy, we're seeing very clearly spelled out in Japan. But the overall nuclear threat persists and is not being dealt with, partly because there's so much mistrust between the United States and Russia still today.
Yeah, I saw. I had to smile. There was a review, one of the reviews of the TV show. They have a vignette about a high school student, a young lady who comes into the room and is watching part of the show about World War II, and she's amazed that the United States did not win World War II by itself. And I laugh at that because, you know, I had that. We all learned that stuff. Yeah, there might have been somebody else fighting in this thing, but really it was us. We came in and mopped it up. But Oliver, you must hear that a lot. That
yes,
kind of, yeah.
You know, the end of World War II was meaning Russia won the war against Germany, destroyed the German war machine, and contributed greatly to our cause against Japan by invading China, Manchuria in August of 45. It made a huge difference. They obliterated the Kwantung Army, which was like 700,000 Japanese soldiers. You know, they were a very serious threat for Japan, and Japan surrendered, we argued in our series, largely because of the Russian invasion, because their own economy was completely devastated by our bombing. Our terror bombing, and also because they wanted to surrender. They were exhausted, and we knew that they wanted to surrender. Truman knew that. The cables had revealed it. He saw it. He saw the embassy, the telegrams of the Japanese embassies, and he went ahead with this bombing because we built this bomb. And basically, it was a very huge financial experiment as well. And it was once we build something in the U.S., we want to use it. So I think this bomb was not dropped on the Japanese. It was dropped to warn the Russians, who was the boss after World War II.
You make the point in the book, of course, that this idea of American exceptionalism is not new. It's been around a long time, but it does have a special prominence now, it seems, in large part because of the media environment. You got people that can spend their whole lives in a media bubble getting their news only from news outlets whose views already agree with their own and don't challenge beliefs.
I'd like to address something that was kind of like skipped over just quickly because
okay,
I think
sure.
It's important to a lot of your audience if your audience is divided on this issue. I mean, when Peter was saying, yes, we have maintained a very strong nuclear presence through with Russia. We also have control of space, air, land, cyber warfare. We're developing new weapons. We're the mightiest empire that ever existed, militarily stocked to the teeth. We have 700 to 1,000 foreign bases. We don't know even how many there are. They're secret. We're all over Africa now. And now, with the Asia pivot, all over China. A lot of people in your audience would say, so? The Russians, they're dangerous too, and they're going to come after us if we don't go after them. That's that dog-eat-dog, law-of-the-jungle attitude that is really at the heart of this thing. Because if you look at the history very specifically, as we have, you'll see that we built the bomb first, and we used it first, and we didn't hesitate. We proved devastatingly that we could be as barbaric as anybody in human history, if not more so. Our terror bombing of Japan was one of the most significant military actions of all time. It was it was an example for history, you know. And our bombing in Vietnam was even worse than World War II, and a huge example to history of what we were able to do. As Noam Chomsky argued, he said, you know, everybody says we lost the Vietnam War. We didn't lose it. We trashed the place so entirely that we scared everybody, and we reminded people of the barbarism that exists in our country. So, you know, it wasn't that we were attacked. Right? Vietnam didn't come after our national security. And Russia never did, because once we had superiority over Russia, and we built it up under Truman and Eisenhower. We always had it. We never lost it. The irony of this thing is that we had a first strike capability against the Soviet Union.
Oliver, I have to interrupt you there. John Fogerty with the Foo Fighters doing a remake of a song you know, Fortunate Son, a Creedence classic updated. We'll be back with more of Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick and the untold history of the United States right after this. We continue our conversation with Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick about their massive and important project, The Untold History of the United States, right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Oliver Stone, I read on your Twitter feed an op-ed piece that you and Peter wrote for, I think it's USA Today. I hope it's out already, but maybe it's not. And it makes the point that we're pretty ignorant when it comes to history. I mean, American students, for example, know very little. I know I've seen these tests about geography. Americans couldn't tell you the difference between Iran and Iraq or find them on a map or show where Afghanistan is. That's sort of central to the message you're delivering with the book.
Yes, Peter, who's a professor and can tell you about high school polling, right?
Well, yeah, according to the National Report Card issued in 2011, American high school seniors tested most poorly of every subject there was, most poorly in U.S. history. Only 12% of high school seniors in this country were deemed to be proficient in their understanding of U.S. history, worse than even in science and math. So that's the real problem that we're confronting. And what they learn is this idea that you started to raise before about American exceptionalism. And I think it's worth revisiting that for a minute.
Yeah.
Because it goes way back. I mean, we can trace it back to Winthrop's sermon aboard the Arbella in 1630, when he says that the colony of Massachusetts is going to be like a city upon the hill for all the world to watch. But that idea then you get picked up by Woodrow Wilson when he says after the Versailles Conference, says now the world will see America as the savior of the world. That idea continues more quietly for a lot of decades, but then gets really pushed forward in a very big way by Ronald Reagan. That's the essence of Reaganism, this idea that the United States, again, is this, he says, shining city upon a hill. The same time that Reagan is supporting death squads in Central America, supporting the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, who later become our enemy now with Al-Qaeda, that's when he starts to pronounce this. But then it gets picked up. One of the things people don't realize is that this is a very bipartisan idea. It was Madeleine Albright, as Secretary of State in the late 90s, who said, if we have to use force, it's because we're America, we're the indispensable nation. It's been picked up in the same way by Hillary Clinton, who says, we're America, we're the indispensable nation, we are the force for progress, prosperity and peace, the same time that she authorizes the war in Iraq, supports the attack on Afghanistan, supports the war against Libya, now recently has been supporting the bombing of Syria, but it gets picked up by Obama also. So this is not just a conservative position. When Obama welcomed home the troops at Fort Bragg, he said, that's what makes us special as Americans. We go there and we sacrifice for people we don't even know, because that's who we are. That's what we do as Americans. It was Alan Greenspan, the head of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, who said that I'm saddened that it's politically inconvenient to acknowledge what everyone knows, the Iraq War is largely about oil. But Obama's professing that it's about these highfalutin notions of freedom and liberty. But that idea of exceptionalism is dangerous, and it gets picked up so aggressively by Reagan in the 1980s because he's trying to combat the notion that Vietnam was not only a bad war, but it was a war full of atrocities and war crimes that brought out the absolute worst in the United States. And in order to do that, he has to develop this alternative notion that we're the city upon the hill, we only do good in the world. And so it's a very dangerous idea because it does lead us to more and more wars and military interventions. This idea that we're different, we're altruistic, we're special, and we're exceptional.
I read a lot of history, but there was something I read in your book I'd never heard before, and it's this top secret memo from George Kennan back in 1948 that sort of outlines the underpinnings of modern reliance on American exceptionalism, but kind of admits that the whole thing is a facade. Oliver, you remember that memo?
Oh, very well, yeah. It was, we have 50% of the world's wealth and 6% of its population, and we can't really indulge in sentimental talk and platitudes, and we have to really get to the business of owning the world, of governing the world, of pushing people around, and basically grabbing the resources that we can so we can keep going as a nation, as the world's number one power.
Yeah, he says that our main goal in the coming period is to devise a pattern of relationships which will permit us to maintain this position of disparity, that the goal of American power is to make sure that the United States maintains a disproportionate amount of the world's wealth.
I mean, you know, exceptionalism as reflected in the interests of corporate America. You mentioned in the book about Kissinger sort of picking up on this and using it to justify all sorts of things. I guess if you're ignorant of American history to begin with, you'll buy anything. And if you believe that we're only doing good in the world, then the ends justify the means.
Absolutely. Once, you know, might makes right. It's an old cliche, but it seems to be the what kids learn in America. Might makes right. We admire the number one, we admire the heavyweight boxer, we admire the number one football team. We like, and we have the, I always run into this wherever I go, into people who say, well, if we don't do it, someone else would. Now, that's an interesting viewpoint, but it doesn't necessarily, it isn't necessarily true. It's possible that the world has existed at times with several strong empires without war. I mean, I have to remind, the Ottoman Empire lasted about 600 years, 700 years. I mean, there was no need for conflict, except in the primal mind. We can change that personality, as Einstein said, you know, we go a long way towards living together in peacefully, and I believe that's possible. I mean, we could have a strong Russia, a strong China, a strong Iran, a strong Venezuela, believe it or not, a strong Brazil. We could have a world balances of power that exist, and I think successfully.
You know, I pointed out to the
listeners. That was Roosevelt's vision in World War II. Roosevelt talked at times about the three policemen and the four policemen. And he thought that we and the Russians and the Brits and the French and the Chinese would be able to work together in maintaining peace. And he also had this hope for the United Nations as a way to maintain peace in the world. But he was willing to allow other countries to get a share of the power. And he thought his last memo that he sends, his last cable, says to Churchill, these differences between us and the Russians pop up every day. We shouldn't make too much of them. There's no reason why we can't continue to work in friendship and harmony in the post-war period. Roosevelt believed that the U.S. and the Russians would maintain friendship and be able to impose a reign of peace on the world after World War II. But Truman, when he takes over, when Roosevelt dies on April 12th, within less than 10 days, Truman has poisoned the relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union. Truman has begun to treat them as enemies. He begins to accuse them of having broken their agreements, even though he later learns that they were the ones who had interpreted correctly, and we weren't. But right from the beginning, we begin to undermine the potential for friendship, which is what we've done repeatedly, as Oliver was suggesting, rather than look for ways to work together. You know, if we think of our relationship with the Russians now, what are the things that are causing so much mistrust between the United States and Russia? A lot of things certainly that Putin's doing that we don't like in terms of gay rights and other things, but there are three big things that the Russians hate. One is that we're surrounding them with this missile defense system. Two is that we're pushing NATO up to Russia's doorstep. And three is our weaponization of space, which Russia and China have been trying to oppose in the United Nations for years. But the United States refused to cooperate on this. We said we've got to dominate space, and we're not going to cooperate on anybody about finding ways to demilitarize space.
I had told the listeners right from the beginning, the last time you were here, that the book, you guys are equal opportunity bashers. It's not a liberal screed. I mean, you take on everybody, Truman and Clinton and, you know, the Reagan, everybody, the Bushes, everyone with equal fervor. But, you know, at the end of the book, you sort of have expressed sort of optimism about what Obama might lead us to, that he, and in the last year, you'd have to admit, it's been a disappointment. I just wonder if it's difficult for you, because I see these sort of teases online from people saying, boy, you must be swallowing hard to admit that Obama is just like the rest of them. You know, and I suspect that you figured he might end up that way all the way along.
Well, actually, we had a lot of hope for him, like many people did back in 2008. But it didn't take long for Oliver and me to lose hope that Obama was going to be any different. We saw who he brought in as advisors. His economic team, were the New York Times referred to them as a constellation of Rubenites. These were all Robin Rubin people, Robert Rubin. They were Timothy Geithner and Larry Summers and Rahm Emanuel and Peter Orszag. These were the worst of the worst. Then his foreign policy team, Hillary Clinton, Robert Gates, General Jones. I mean, these were hawks. So Oliver and I were very disappointed by the way Obama began to govern. He had a couple good days. He said he was going to close Guantanamo. He was going to pull back on some of the excesses of the Bush administration, stop torture. It's a good thing to stop torture. But very quickly, Obama adopts hawkish policies overseas, and his bailout policies were certainly not in the interest of the American people. They might have helped Wall Street, but they were not wise policies. But what we recognize is that Obama, unlike Bush, you know, had a certain level of intelligence, was very articulate, thoughtful about policies, and did not seem to be a gung-ho cowboy. And we've seen this proven out. They had a really box him in and give him no options before he agreed to triple number of forces in Afghanistan. Even more recently, he was very hesitant about bombing Syria. He gets caught by his own mistakes and then doesn't have the backbone to stand up to the military the way John Kennedy stood up to the military. But Obama is not George Bush, and he's not Lyndon Johnson, and he's not Ronald Reagan. He's got a certain kind of decency that and intelligence that could be appealed to, and we're hoping to do that and to reach him in some way.
Oliver, I love a good conspiracy yarn, maybe more than you do. I wonder if there's a day where somebody comes in and tells the new president, tells Obama, for example, here's the way it works, and you're going to toe the line or not, or he learns this on his own.
Well, I don't think it's that overt at all. No, I think that when you become a chief executive of this country, I think the pressure is intense. I think you're briefed constantly by your military intelligence team. You're surrounded by them. You're bodyguarded by them. You're told every day, probably, about threats to your life as well as threats to the country. And we live in such a fragile place in America, with such fear, frankly, that was enhanced by Bush's reaction to the terror of 2001. And so that if it happened again, my imagination can't even run to the lengths to which we could go. We could lose our minds. And, you know, it doesn't matter if Obama's president or not. Let's say it's more of a right-winger. With this ability, this technology that we have to eavesdrop on everybody could be thrown into suspicion. The country could be one vast jail. It could be worse than anything that George Orwell ever dreamed of. Out of a fear that has grown to this proportion, and a fear of terrorists. As you said at the top of the show, it was a couple of thousand terrorists have done this to the mindset of a great country.
You think that Obama worries about what happened to John Kennedy and thinks,
I think those days are kind of gone. I don't think that they do that anymore. I think that there's so much pressure in the media now. The media is bigger than ever. There's so much pressure from the bond market, from Wall Street. There's enormous pressure from the Pentagon, which is bigger than when Kennedy left it. So, you know, and there's a sort of a consensus, a fear of breaking out of the box. I mean, it's very hard to try things that are new, as you can see just from the healthcare plan. So I don't see it happening that way. I think the president can be very intimidated by as Clinton was, by Congress and by the news media and by Wall Street. Wall Street comes to you and says, look, you can't shake things up like this. It's much more subtle.
The idea that capitalism and democracy are one and the same, Peter, that must be disturbing to you to have to deal with that in class. But it seems to be a popular myth now.
Well, it's been a popular myth for decades, in that somehow democracy is defined by the markets. And, I mean, the very, very narrow definition of democracy. Louis Brandeis said once, you can have democracy or you can have capitalism and accumulation of wealth, but you can't have both. That's an idea that goes back to the 19th century. The Republican vision, the small R Republican vision that was embraced by Walt Whitman, among others, was predicated on the assumption that if you're going to have democracy, then there's got to be a rough equality of wealth in the country. But then once we start building up the great corporate fortunes, the robber barons in the late 19th century, and the vast accumulation of wealth, as you know, the gap between rich and poor in the United States is by far more than any other advanced industrial country in the world. And we see the way that operates. We see the way the Koch brothers, the influence that they're having. I mean, one of the things is that it's crazy is our inattention to global warming. But the Koch brothers are financing a network of science deniers and science falsifiers, people who get funded by Koch brothers, by the energy industry, the big oil companies, who go out there and literally spread lies that goes against what is being said by 99% of the scientists in this country. So we're up against the malefactors of great wealth, but we have something else on our side, and that's truth. And I think that Oliver has important characters say in JFK, he says, deep down, people are suckers for the truth. And we're basing our hopes for actually having some impact and trying to change people on the basis that if we can reach them with the truth, we think that they're going to be receptive. And it was why we're trying to get into all these different forums, trying to get into the schools, on the radios, all the media. We go to campuses all over the country and other countries with the idea that if we can get people an alternative sense of history, then they can begin to question a lot of things that they took for granted. And they can see that there's potential to make changes that they might otherwise not have been able to envision.
One of the expressions of optimism you had in the book, toward the end of the book, is you mentioned about Time Magazine's Person of the Year in 2011 was the protester, specifically the Wall Street protesters who had started what looked like a big movement. Poof, it's gone. I mean, it's largely gone.
The movement is gone, but the idea isn't gone. We even saw a populist turn in Obama for a period of time as a result of the pressure of the Occupy movement. The Occupy movement, in my opinion, did not have the structure to endure as a movement. But it did have a message. And the message was that if 1% of the people dominate the wealth of the country and 99% of the people are excluded, then you have an untenable and unworkable situation. And so, I mean, that's festering there. People have more of an understanding of inequality and the effects of it than they did before because they're living through it. And they're living through the recovery to this recession. And in this recovery, all the wealth has gone again to the top 1%, the top 0.1%. And most of the people are still hurting and have some people have gotten some benefits in recent years, but nothing compared to where they were even just a few years ago. So I see that movement as being somewhat successful in changing the thinking and the discourse about wealth. And that's a step. We don't know what spark is going to be required to rekindle a movement like that. But that's part of what we're about also.
Oliver, you get disillusioned when you look at the powers that be, the Wall Street guys, the big money guys, most of them conservative, controlling all the levers of power.
No, I do get depressed about it. Didn't you at the top of the show have a newscast that said something about today? There was a demonstration in Washington about the National Security Act.
Yeah.
So that seems to be a very, very hopeful thing. People are aware of it. There are people who are concerned about it. Most people don't. I guess they accept it because it's that new world. Nobody quite knows. Everything seems to be transparent, but I don't accept it. I don't accept it, and I'm very happy that I keep talking about it, and I think Europe and Asia would be upset about being listened in on. We've got to keep pushing the idea of individual dignity and rights. Got to keep pushing that. Never give up on that against the corporations. Never. I think that's our great hope. As Peter said, or JFK said, people are suckers for the truth. They want to feel that there's a freedom and a respect and a dignity for their own private life. It's the basis. That's how America was founded. It's the beauty of America, and we're losing that.
I want to take a, we're going to have to take a break here now. When we come back, I want to jump in into the NSA a little bit further and talk about the widespread, the emergence of the surveillance state, and also get into JFK a little bit. Much more to come here with Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick, authors of The Untold History of the United States. Stay with us, everyone.